Excuse me, everyone. It's the operator. Just need to inform you that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect your line at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you very much, Lori. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the IOG call on the 13th of March, and on the call we have Lanre Ajayi, Christopher Rassi, Thomas Rickert, Stefan Hankins, Chuck Gomes, Elizabeth Finberg, Claudia McMaster-Tamaret, Mason Cole, David Maher, Greg Shatton, Jim Bykoff, and for staff, we have Barry Cobb, Brian Peck, and myself, Glenn DeSaint-Jerry. Have I left anybody off, or has anybody joined the Adobe Connect room that is not on the call? I actually don't see anybody else in the
David Heasley and Kieran are here too.
Oh, thank you very much. Fine. Thank you, Thomas. It's over to you, but just may I remind people to say their name before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Glenn. My name is Thomas Rickert, and I'm the chair of this working group. And as usual, I'd like to ask the group whether there are any updates, the statements of interest. Hearing and seeing none, we can move to the next agenda item, and that is review of General Counsel Research Survey response. And you will have seen that Brian has kindly passed on a document to the mailing list, which is the response from General Counsel, and we have reached out to General Counsel to see whether there's anybody there who could present their findings during today's call, but unfortunately, due to travel, that is not possible, which is why I've asked Brian Peck to show us through the document. And as we do that, our plan is that we try to understand what the reasoning behind the General Counsel response is, and put our questions into the Adobe or to the mailing list, or take them from the transcript and provide those to General Counsel's office. And during next week's call, a representative from the General Counsel will be with us and will be able to discuss the questions and potentially the answers to those questions with us. But first, I'd like Brian to give us this overview. And for the group, please indicate, should you have any questions, I'm sure that Brian will be more than happy to take questions as he talks. Thank you very much, and over to you, Brian.
Thank you, Thomas. This is Brian Peck from ICANN staff. And as Thomas mentioned, you know, we did circulate the report from the General Counsel's Office summarizing the results of their survey research in response to the questions posed to them by the working group. So I think the scope of the research and the executive summary are pretty straightforward, but what I'd like to do, if it's okay with the group, and as Thomas mentioned, certainly am willing to discuss or respond to questions to the extent that I can. If not, certainly we will have one, or the intention is, and I think pretty with certainty that we'll have someone from the General Counsel's Office available next Wednesday's call. But I'd like to highlight, I think, two aspects that I think are most relevant that come from this report that are with regards to the work and the current considerations of the working group. The first is in response to the question posed, and that is whether ICANN is aware of any jurisdiction in which a statute, treaty, or other applicable law prohibits either both of the assignment of ICANN at the top level or the registration by registry or registrar accredited by ICANN of a domain name at the second level of either a name or acronym of an IGO or of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, and or IOC names. And I think, you know, as the research has pointed out, at least in the jurisdictions that were reviewed, that, you know, there is no treaty or national law that specifically prohibits the allowance of the registration of any of these organizations' names or acronyms at either the top or second level, with the exception of Brazil, as noted in the research. And again, that particular Brazilian statute is pertinent only to the IOC and FIFA. related names. And it's come to our attention as well that there are some protective statutes in Mexico, which I think they will update that particular aspect of the annex with the summary of the jurisdiction's review. But again, in answer to the question, there is no specific, at least based on the research and the jurisdictions reviewed, there is no specific treaty or law that prohibits the allowance of the registration of a domain name, again, either at the first or second level, the second level domain names, and of course the first name at the top level of a GTLD. I think the other aspect we'd like that the report highlights is with regard to the protections provided to both the Red Cross, Red Crescent, and IOC organizations, as well as IGOs in specific jurisdictions. The report kind of helps to better understand what is the nature of those protections. And again, as the report points out, both in the summary and in the summary of the jurisdiction itself, although there are not specific prohibitions of the allowance of the registration of such names and acronyms of these organizations, there are certainly laws that provide protections for these names and organizations at various levels that would at least perhaps cause or provide grounds to challenge such registrations by unauthorized third parties, either at the top level or second level. With regards to the IGO names, I think it's interesting to note, as I said, that many countries afford special protection for IGOs listed in Article 6 TER of the Paris Convention, but often there's a registration or notice process or member state limitation to which each jurisdiction develops that list of specific IGOs that are recognized for protection. So again, I think what this research does point out in terms of what is available protections in specific jurisdictions, there are certainly laws in several jurisdictions that provide a heightened level of protection for the names and acronyms of these organizations themselves, not specifically for domain names, but certainly at the very least providing grounds for, again, challenges for the allowance or the registration of such names, either at the top level or second level. So I think, again, then, as I say, you go through the chart and you can see the specific statutes relevant to each jurisdiction in terms of the protection of both IOC, IRC, Red Crescent protections and or the IGO protections. So those are, I think, as I say, not going into the rereading what exactly is in the scope or the executive summary, I think those were two aspects that I thought would be important to highlight coming out of this report.
Thanks very much, Brian. And before I open it up to the group for questions, I'd like to add that while we have asked a very general question whether General Counsel is aware of any laws providing protections to these four categories of organizations, and now General Counsel has looked at 11 jurisdictions in detail, the reason for picking 11 of those 11 jurisdictions was that they wanted to cover jurisdictions in all ICANN regions. So even though the number of jurisdictions that have been looked at might appear to be relatively low at first glance, I think still this provides a good overview of the legal protection schemes in the various ICANN regions. I think that's something for us to bear in mind when we discuss this. Let me open up the floor for questions from the group, and more specifically, let me ask you whether you as working group participants think that this answers your questions. Are your concerns responded to? Is this a solid basis on which you can now proceed to discuss potential protections? Who wants to go first? I see Chuck's hand up. Please, Chuck.
Well, since nobody else had raised their hand, I thought I'd help out. This is Chuck.
Thanks.
Well, I certainly didn't find the General Counsel's response definitive in any way. And as a registry, we need to rely on that. So one of the things that we had talked about in the registry stakeholder group when we suggested these questions was if in fact the law is very clear from an international point of view and multinational point of view, then this could be just a compliance matter. Certainly from what I get out of this, it's not that simple. And so, whereas I think the GAC believes that it's simpler, and the organizations that we're talking about believe it's more clear-cut, this certainly doesn't give me that definitive answer as being proposed by others. So that's my perception on this.
Chuck, a quick follow-up question. So that would mean that in the absence of this clear guidance that protections are in place that would prevent registries and registrars from allowing certain registrations to happen, you would now regard this as a policy matter and not a compliance matter. Is my understanding correct?
Good question, Thomas. Essentially, I think my answer is yes to that. Let me state it a little differently, though. Even if the analysis by the General Counsel's office was definitive on these issues, we could, as you've heard me say before, I think we could still develop policy to facilitate the registration process. One of the things that the registries have wanted all along is to have something to hang our hat on that's outside of us. You know, in other words, if there is clearly some legal protections, then it's pretty easy then to give that as a rationale for developing policy. In this case, because it's not very definitive, that's not as good a thing to hang our hat on, but there may be some things in this that we can use as guidelines as we consider whether to develop policy. And as you'll hear from David Maher as well, you know, we're at a point where we will go back to the registry stakeholder group as a whole and get direction from them in terms of the whole group's thinking on this.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. Maybe for those who haven't yet had the chance to go through the report in detail, General Counsel has made very clear that they're not going to provide legal advice to registries and registrars as to their liability risk, and they leave it up to them to seek that legal advice, which sort of is an indication that they were not willing or able to respond to one of the aspects that we have explicitly asked for. The IOC is next, so either Jim, David, or Kieran, please.
It's Jim. Two points. I think it's, first of all, understandable that they did not find specific information or guidelines in these statutes on domain names, except as they said for Brazil, and of course they didn't, one of the jurisdictions that they did not look at was Greece, where there is specific protection for domain names. So that's two. But the other thing is that most of these statutes and treaties were passed at a time when the internet didn't exist, so it's very natural that it doesn't include specific protections of domain names. But I think the General Counsel's opinion did one thing that I thought was very interesting, and without giving an assessment of the likelihood of liability, it did say that there was a risk of liability under all of these statutes, and that risk would depend on a number of factors, and they outlined the factors within the opinion as they have duty of care, accessories to acts of dilution or infringement, et cetera. So I mean, this is not clearly an opinion that says there is no liability, and it doesn't say that there is liability. They don't want to make that call, but they say there may be liability. There is a potential for liability I would say, a risk for liability, and that risk could be defined by different guidelines that are set forth and perhaps others depending on the jurisdiction. So that's about it. We went over the report very carefully. The information on Mexico, which Brian referred to, it left out a statute of specific protection for the Olympic marks, which we've given to Brian and which I think will be included in the next revision on this opinion.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Jim. I have one follow-up question for you, though, and that's maybe also a question that should be asked to General Counsel. You were talking about the general liability risks that are or might be involved with the registration of certain designations pertaining to the four categories of organizations. When I read the report, I thought that this particular aspect was not satisfactory to me because I guess what we were looking for when drafting the General Counsel request was to seek guidance whether there were any protections, legal statutory protections, that would give the designations of the four categories of organizations a special level of protection that would separate them from rights, name rights holders or trademark owners. While the risks described in the General Counsel report, to me, don't seem to be any different from the general liability risks of registries that registries and registrars face when their customers choose to register domain names that infringe upon third parties' rights. So even though I agree in the report that it's written that there are liability risks, but as it is written, what I haven't seen there, and maybe you have, and this is why I'm asking it to you and to the whole group, is have I missed something? Can we actually derive benefits for our answers that we're seeking from this? And to me, it seems like in this particular aspect, the answer is no, because the liability risks do not in any way separate the four categories of organizations from any other rights holders and the associated risks for registries and registrars. Jim, would you like to maybe follow up on that now or later?
Well, I think that one of the things I was going to say is in the research reform, they specifically referred to the IOC and Red Cross that are most likely to have special protections afforded based on prior research performed. And then if you go into the jurisdictions, there are comments in each section, or not in each section, there are comments in some of the sections which say things like the protection may extend to specifically to domain names, although they're not specifically enumerated, such as in South Africa. These protections could exist at the top and second level for domain names, though not specifically enumerated. So, I mean, it's not a very, it doesn't give this type of information for every single country, but I think it shows some countries where they believe that there could be a risk of liability, another one being Germany, where they say for either of these provisions, while domain name registrations are not specifically identified, those who are on notice of the infringing use of a name or acronym at the top second level could be held liable. Now, it's not clear to me that that's directed specifically at registries and registrars, but they're trying to answer the B part of the question, I think, not the A part. They've said they're not going to discuss ICANN's potential for liability.
Yeah, Jim, I was just, you mentioned the report on Germany, and I'm quite familiar with the landscape of court decisions in Germany with respect to registry and registrar liability. And in at least in that jurisdiction, the risks described would be risks generally that are there generally for registries and registrar for any type of infringing registrations by customers of these organizations. But, that's been very helpful, though. Greg, please.
A couple of comments. First, I guess I wasn't terribly surprised at most of what the General Counsel's Office came back with. It's my experience that, you know, laws are, you know, generally drafted, you know, fairly generally, without reference to kind of specific media or applications. One of the things that lawyers have to constantly deal with is what some have described as old wine in new bottles. I can remember reading articles when I was a law student about how, you know, things were, you know, IP law was changing. You know, it wasn't changing as quickly as the application of IP facts to it had to be, and that's really hasn't changed much. Occasionally you get laws that are written specifically to domain names like ACPA and other things, but by and large, you know, we're stuck applying, you know, laws of general applicability. That's kind of, you know, where that whole thing seems to have ended up. I think the issue of whether there are specific, you know, categorical imperatives for the different organizations, and I do think that, you know, 6TER protection for IGOs and for states, for that matter, you know, is different from, you know, brand owner protection. The liabilities, you know, may not be per se different, but there are only so many different forms of liability that one can have. The thing that I found the most, that I found missing from the general counsel's paper more than anything else was any treatment that of the issues of INGOs as a class. And they dealt with IOC and RCRC, and they dealt with IGOs as a class, which, you know, pretty much 6TER pretty much is, you know, tells most of the story there. But INGOs are not states by definition; they're non-governmental, so they can't be part of the 6TER party, and they're clearly not the IOC or the RCRC. So they seem to have just kind of been left by the side of the road during the bathroom break on the bus trip to getting this thing done. So it's that's of concern to me. Not that I necessarily felt they would have found anything earth-shattering, but it would have been nice to have the opinion deal with kind of four quarters and not three quarters of, you know, of the organizational kind of subsets that we've identified. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. As to where that piece might have been lost, I think that's up to everybody's imagination. I think the easiest way for us to find out is just ask, and I'm sure that Brian will take good note of that and ask the general counsel to add that piece of work to the provisional report. Chuck?
Yeah, just to follow up on what Greg said, I noticed the same thing. I mean, there's nothing in there to provide any justification for protecting INGOs except for the Red Cross and the IOC. I kind of had the impression that we'd kind of come to that conclusion already in our discussions, that we're not going to be able to base any policy from regarding INGOs except for Red Cross and IOC on the basis of laws. I had kind of come to that conclusion anyway. So it is missing from the report, I agree, but I had already kind of come to the conclusion that we weren't, based on all of our discussions, that international treaties or even multinational laws weren't going to help us very much with regard to INGOs. That's just my perception.
Thanks, Chuck. Nonetheless, we should ask this follow-up question to General Counsel to see clarity whether they have actually looked at that and did not share any findings with us, or whether they simply did omit that part of the work. Greg, please.
Thomas, can I get in the queue? It's Claudia.
Claudia, certainly. You're in after Greg.
Yeah,
thank you.
I agree with what Chuck said, and I didn't expect to find anything exciting, but it would have at least been nice to see somebody else's, you know, research, that there was nothing special there when we had asked for it. I think another thing that strikes me, at least for common law countries, you know, the law of the statute is only the beginning, especially when we're talking about statutes that are written for, you know, general applicability. So it's really the cases that define and expand and change and sometimes mutate the law. So, you know, obviously there was, it doesn't seem like there's any, you know, looking at particular case law. I found an interesting article, maybe not entirely germane to our discussion. I did not write it. I just found it. I'll distribute it around. Was printed January 2011, so God knows what's happened in 2 years, in Intellectual Property magazine, entitled New Trends in Cyber Squatting Law, Domain Name Registrars May Be Held Liable for Contributory Infringement. So it at least, you know, discusses the issue of registrar liability. Doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't discuss it in the context of any of these particular subsets of organizations, but, you know, it does point out that, you know, taking the general laws as a background, some courts have found under certain factual circumstances registrar liability. So, and that's only in the U.S., of course. I thought that might be
Greg, before I move to Claudia, but isn't that a confirmation sort of the notion that I expressed earlier, that certainly there are cases in which registries and registrars might face liability, but is this actually something that would be special to the four categories of organization? You know, the reason why we are meeting every week and exchanging emails in between our discussions is to see whether we can find any objective criteria that make these four categories of organizations so unique that they deserve protection, and possibly, as we see now, protection beyond what's granted by law. And therefore, I think, at least for me, but you can certainly convince me otherwise, or you don't have to convince me, but the rest of the group, I think that the general aspects of liability that are not special to these organizations don't help us come up with an objective demarcation. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree with that. I mean, I think the way I look at the question posed to the General Counsel Office in some cases, you know, two parts, which is, you know, what liability is there for registrars and registries, and also for ICANN, which they, you know, explicitly declined to express a view on. And secondly, you know, if there is liability in general, or can be, you know, how, you know, or even if there's not, you know, how does that apply, you know, specifically to these subsets? So I think there's, you know, obviously registrant liability is a whole, you know, is a whole separate issue we didn't need to get into, but I just thought it was, you know, interesting to see at least case law on registrar liability before getting to the question of whether there's anything specific. But there isn't anything, you know, clearly it all depends on what cases, you know, parties were involved. So whether the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which is involved in one of these cases, is a non-governmental organization. They're the people that host the Oscars. I have no opinion on that, but they are one of the plaintiffs in one of these cases.
Thanks, Greg. And if you can, maybe you can share the source of this article with the group on the mailing list.
Sure.
Claudia is next, please.
Hi, Thomas. Claudia. I also understood a lot of the description from the General Counsel's letter to mean it's not clear that there is sort of a, if I can call it, strict liability just for the registration of particular names and acronyms of some of these organizations. That being said, I was also disheartened that that INGOs, excluding the IOC and the Red Cross, were not included in particular for INGOs, for example, have famous marks and that might have well over 100 trademark registrations, for example, and can look to particular trees as well to show that they have, if you want, a heightened protection over just one national trademark registration. That, again, being said, I think that all of this discussion that basically says, well, if there isn't a strict liability, if there isn't even on a national level, and then question mark if one nation should be the basis for any kind of a policy decision that is going to affect the entire world's uses of the internet. That being said, I think we need to then really focus on objective criteria and the idea of there being a sort of non-discriminatory public interest policy reason for granting special protections, if at all. Otherwise, it's going to be up to we leave it up to the particular countries to decide how liability should fall.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Any further comments? I mean, certainly you can come in later with comments and questions. For the time being, my question to the group would be, what do we make out of that? Clearly, the INGO part is missing, and we should ask whether General Counsel has given this any thought. I've heard a couple of times that the response in general does not come as a surprise to certain participants of this working group. So are we happy with the answer as it is, despite the fact, despite the aspect of INGOs? Is there a wish by the group for the General Counsel to put further work into that and look at additional aspects? And if the group chose to ask for additional work be put into that, what is the expectation? So let me rephrase my question. Does anybody of you, apart from the INGO aspect, wish for the General Counsel to conduct additional work on this? So you can come in later and ask for that, but for the moment, let me just state that there are no requests for additional work.
And now, hello, Thomas, this is Claudia.
Claudia, please.
I'd like to say that we don't have that much time, so I don't know if we would be requesting the General Counsel to come back in a month's time and wait for us as a working group to submit a recommendation. That being said, I think it's work that absolutely has to be done, and any recommendation that this working group makes should note that work is still missing.
Agreed, Claudia. And as I said, we're going to ask for the INGO bit part of the work anyway, and that should be added to the current report. But, you know, my question is in more general terms whether the group is satisfied with the answer as it stands, whether even though the outcome was predicted by some of us, if not all, whether that's a solid basis for us to proceed on. My impression was that at least parts of the working group have waited for the response from General Counsel to be able to continue the work on the subject. And, you know, if you ask for my personal opinion as chair, I think we should move on, bearing in mind these responses. We should also have a brief discussion with a representative from General Counsel during next week's call. But in order to save time, you know, knowing that the outcome might not be different or substantially different from what we know now, we should not further wait or ask General Counsel to put substantive resources into this exercise. And seeing no objection to that, I think we should keep that as an interim result. Nonetheless, I still need an answer to my question from the group, what we make out of that. I'm sure that some of you have eagerly awaited this result or the result from General Counsel to then make a determination as to how to move on, and I'd be interested in hearing how you amalgamate the response that we now have into your thinking. I'm sure that at least some of you have given this some thought, because this response has been eagerly awaited, and we've asked for it in the first place, and I'm sure that you wanted to make some good use of the outcome.
Hi, Thomas. This is Claudia. Can I get in the queue?
Yes, please. I have David first, and then it's going to be your turn. David, please. David, we can't hear you.
Sorry, yes. Yeah, I just wanted to say I don't think it changes anything, and that's really all I can say about it.
Thanks, David. I now have Claudia and then Greg.
Hi, Thomas. I'd actually like to echo that statement as well and say that at least from our perspective, ISO's perspective, the General Counsel's view, or rather report, doesn't change our position. We still strongly hold fast to the idea that any special protections are going to have to be based on the worldwide public interest and internet users' interest in protecting the names of international organizations.
Thank you, Claudia. Greg?
This will be one of those times where I agree with David and also with Claudia. I think it doesn't change anything. To some extent, I feel like the mountain has labored and brought forth a mouse. Obviously, a lot of work went into it, but I would like to see that amount of work go into the INGO piece as well, but not expecting any revelations there either. Thanks,
Greg. Unless there are further comments on this one, I think we can move to the third item. And you will remember that we have originally, or that we discussed this last week, and that some of you said that they will only be able to make a final determination as regards the qualification criteria when they have looked at the various protections and the mechanisms that we're discussing, i.e. top-level protections versus second-level protections, and then protections during sunrise, during general availability, protection for identical names, for exact match acronyms, or similar strings. Now, I have encouraged the group multiple times, as you know, to come up with proposals for these additional qualification criteria or admission criteria, and some thoughts on that have been exchanged, and you find the current status of the discussion in the document that Barry just brought up. And I think during this week's call, we should not spend too much time on that, but since there have been some developments, I know that Avery has been posting some proposals, so have Jim, Kieran, and David. I wanted to give an opportunity to the group to further discuss this, and I have omitted Mary, who has also made a proposal, and then certainly the helpful contributions from Chuck and many others in the group. So would anybody like to comment on that or make additional proposals with respect to these criteria?
Thomas, this is Barry.
Barry, please.
Just to inform the working group, what you see before you in this version 6 of the qualification criteria history, for lack of a better word. So over the list this past week, the IOC group had put forward a version that basically combined Model Alpha and Bravo from our previous version. And so that's what you see at the top of this list right here, is that version. And then I'd also like to point out that Model Charlie did exist in our previous version, which was kind of offered up back on the list by Mary on 6 March. And I think for the most part, if the working group agrees, that Model Charlie is really just a different version of what is listed up in Alpha and Bravo, just kind of in a simpler form. So if there are no objections, I'll probably migrate the Charlie model down to our history timeline, because I do believe everything that it represents is captured in the what I'm calling Alpha Bravo now. And then Model Delta is what Aubrey had posted onto the list last week as well, just so trying to keep everything corralled together. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. I'd certainly be okay with eliminating one of those models and put them into the history part of the document. Any objections to that? Hearing and seeing none, I suggest, Barry, that you proceed as you proposed. And then certainly we should all bear in mind that these general criteria are deemed to be sort of the starting point to be able to fence in a relatively small group of organizations that would be eligible for for protection, but that there might be additional hurdles to actually get access to protections. And the wish of the group was that, or at least parts of the group was that, the additional hurdles and their height should depend on the impact of the protection mechanism. So the broader the protection and the broadest form was called blocking, the harsher the criteria should ultimately be. So in case there are no additional remarks on this one, I suggest that we leave the subject and move to the protection matrix spreadsheet.
Thomas, this is Barry. Just one more quick comment about this. As I've tried to gather and corralling all the different proposals here for the qualification criteria, I still think that there are some divergent views about what this overall model may look like. I'm just curious if the working group would agree or if it would benefit that, you know, when we've boiled down what the proposals may or may not look like, will it benefit to actually take a representative sample of IGO and INGO organizations to understand which ones would qualify and which ones wouldn't? Or is it already clear to the working group what omissions of certain organizations may look like? Basically, kind of use case testing what the model looks like and what it may or may not produce.
Any views on that?
Hi, Thomas. This is Claudia. Can I get in the queue?
It's your turn, actually.
Okay, thank you. Just to say yes, I think that we would really appreciate that. I think for some case testing to occur, particularly when it comes to and I apologize, my phone has been coming in and off, in and out, so I'm not sure I've been able to follow quite clearly the last 15 minutes. But when it comes to ideas of multinational or multilateral protection, I think it's important for us to have a more clear idea of what that exactly means, and in particular, if that's meant to bar multinational trademark holders, for example, who are INGOs, but are not particularly referenced in a treaty or something like this.
And do you have an idea as to what organizations you want to see reflected? Maybe you don't have to say it now, but maybe you can come up with some suggestions for Barry to work on.
Well, I think that we can look at definitely look at some of the well-established INGOs from the general consultative status list. For example, wouldn't be a bad idea to start with. Well, INGOs that have been around, so to speak, for several decades, that might have several member states and have quite well recognized international scope might be a start in terms of making sure that we aren't writing criteria to only include two INGOs.
There is that concrete enough for you to work on?
Yes, this is Barry. I think for kind of an informal start, we'll definitely use the organizations that we conducted the domain registration evaluation. Those are more or less higher profile organizations. Then I'll start to browse through maybe a little bit of the six-tier list and then the ECOSOC list and just kind of pull representative samples. I'll send that out to the mailing list to see if that representative sample is in the ballpark or not, and we can modify accordingly. And then once we finalize that list, then maybe we can throw it into a spreadsheet or some sort of table format that gives the thumbs up or thumbs down as to how they would traverse the qualification criteria that's proposed.
Barry, can I just reply real quick?
Please do.
Also, I think in that list that you're referring to, I think that the only INGOs that were included, weren't they the IOC and the Red Cross? Were there any others?
This is Barry. You're probably right, but I'm not an expert on which organizations fall which class. So that's why I would definitely also want to include pulling samples from SIXTER and from the ECHOSOC list as well.
Okay, definitely feel free to look at my organization, the ISO itself. We've been around for well over 50 years and have over 160 member states and have published some 20,000 almost international standards and have such standing that I think a lot of people confuse us, in fact, with IGOs. But we are an INGO, and we are on also the general consultative status list. So I think if you'd like to take a look at our organization or other organizations like ours, please do feel free to include them.
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia. That's very helpful. I have Chuck now. Chuck, we can't hear you. Maybe you're on mute.
I was. going back to the General Counsel's response, in the IGO category, there were quite a few of the jurisdictions surveyed, there were references to the SIXTER list. In light of that, it seems like it'd be very helpful, and this isn't a request for the General Counsel's office, but something that would be helpful. Maybe staff can help us with this or someone else who's more expert on it than I am. It would be helpful to have a comparison of the SIXTER list of organizations to the GAC-suggested criteria of those that qualify under the .INT list, and for that matter, if it's applicable, I don't even know if it's applicable, the ECOSOC list or any other list that we're considering. Because that was a fairly common thread, not always, but the SIXTER list with regard to IGOs was referred to several times in the organization surveyed. So getting that kind of information, I think, could be useful to us as we work further on criteria.
Chuck, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and I'm not sure who will be able to conduct that comparison, but maybe Barry and Brian, you can take note of that and see whether you have staff resources to do that exercise.
Okay, sure, we can take a look and see.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Unless there are further comments on this qualification criteria proposal, I think we can now move to the protection matrix.
Thomas, it's Barry. I think from last week we left off at the second level matrix.
Yes, I was just about to say that we have gone over the spreadsheet almost two times. First time 2 weeks ago, and then in more detail last week, and. It was my impression that, hopefully, I'm correct in understanding that the group has now understood what the reasoning behind the proposal as it stands is. I think that there was some confusion because not all of the working group participants were aware of the explanations behind it. You know that there's a spreadsheet where the asterisks are explained. But the general response that I got was that there were parts of the working group that thought additional admission criteria should be added to the individual stages or areas of protection.
And for the sake of time, I do and did not plan to go over the whole spreadsheet unless the group explicitly asked me to do so, and in which case we can do that exercise. But I think what I need from the group, what I and everybody needs to understand, is the line of thinking of those that do not think that what's in here is good enough a proposal, and that think harsher admission criteria are required. So I've seen a lot of no's on the mailing list and objections to certain protections and objections to the general notion of blocking or giving privileges to certain organizations. But what I've been missing, I hope I have been clear enough on that, what I've been missing is that people come up with constructive proposals as to what they need in there to satisfy their or to address their concerns. Because if nobody comes up with what they want, there's nothing for us to discuss. And as you will know, I have, as chair, tried to amalgamate what I've heard during the last year's discussion into this, and I've added some of my own thoughts into it just in order to make it what I thought could be a suitable compromise for the group. But I haven't seen any specific information as to what is missing. And I think I, as chair, can't do that. So I think it needs to come from the group. And if there are no suggestions, that leaves room for two answers, one of which is that those who are asking for additional criteria do not know what they are, in which case we're stuck, or they, you know, there is no willingness to come up with concrete proposals because whatever hurdles we might establish will not be high enough because there is a general objection to certain mechanisms or procedures, regardless of what the criteria for those would be. In which case, we can also stop this exercise at this stage and ask the remainder of the group whether they're happy with the mechanism as it stands, and then we can do a provisional consensus call and see whether everybody likes it, and then those who don't like it can say no. Can you understand my concerns? You know, I think I'm getting stuck as chair with because I'm lacking imagination as to what certain parts of the community would like to see the group produce for them to satisfy their concerns. Any views on that? We can work on various aspects forever. I think what I need is some clarity and transparency from the various participants and the groups that they represent as to whether we can do whatever we can, and they would still say no, in which case we should take the shortcut and try to come up with an answer now, which they can say no to, or whether we can expect constructive feedback as to what is missing in this scheme. Chuck, please.
Thanks, Thomas. As I indicated earlier in the call, David and I are at a point where we need to get broader involvement from the full stakeholder group. So it's going to be difficult for us to be too specific until we do that exercise. We've kept them marginally informed up to now. Now that we have the general counsel's response, we're at a point where we think we can go back and propose some different concepts and see where people's heads are and try and get some direction until that point, it's probably going to be fairly difficult for us to be too constructive or to answer some of your questions specifically.
Which is understood, Chuck, and this is not, you know, my response is not directed at you or your group specifically, but it was my impression that some of the participants wanted to see a more holistic picture of what an ultimate recommendation could look like, and that would be something along the lines of what I have, with Barry's help, put together in the spreadsheet, i.e., what would the various protections be? Where should protections be in place? What would be the associated mechanisms with the rough descriptions? So I thought that participants would need a more concrete proposal to take it back to their group and ask for yes or no, and that, you know, unless they saw this complete picture, they wouldn't be able to get feedback from their groups. I have Jim, Kieran, or David next, please.
Hi, Thomas. It's Jim. I just want to say I think we take the position that you've done a terrific job here. I think this is a very difficult task to take viewpoints from so many divergent constituencies. I mean, I don't see how we can ever really all agree on something in this area because the opinions are just so different. But I think we have made some progress, especially, I think, in the qualification criteria. I think a lot of that is due to your having put together a lot of these things, and I can only take my hat off to you because I don't think I could have done that. So, again, I think we owe you a big congratulations.
Thanks so much, Jim. That's very much appreciated. I think that, you know, unless the group asks for it, I think I'm not going to steal your time and go through the spreadsheet again. I think everybody, not only the participants that are on the call, but also those who will hopefully look at the transcript or hear the MP3 or hear through the grapevine what we've been discussing, we'll take a look at that and say, okay, I like most of it, but I don't like certain parts, but I would like them if we would tweak them a little bit and add additional hurdles here or there, then please speak up. I think the group is more than happy to discuss whatever constructive proposals are out there. But in the absence of such proposals being brought forward during this call, I think we should now leave this aspect of the spreadsheet. But what I think we haven't looked at closely enough, and Jim, this is not to put you on the spot, but I know that you and your colleagues have done some work on drafting some general principles for exemption procedures, and maybe we can take a few minutes to discuss those. Barry, I hope that this is not too difficult for you to put up now, but there were concerns by some of the group as to suppression of free speech or that blocking might ultimately exclude certain parties that are eligible for registration of certain designations from doing so. And I think there is more or less consensus in the group that exemption procedures are needed because particularly in the light of the general counsel response now being available to us, there is no general block, or there doesn't appear to be any general statutory block for certain designations to be used by legitimate third parties. And the question certainly is, how do registries and registrars find out what a legitimate third party is, and how do we balance the requests from the four types of organizations to get access to certain names versus other legitimate third parties. And Jim was kind enough to put together some general principles. And Jim, would you feel comfortable to show the group through these bullet points in 2 or 3 minutes?
Sure. I'll do a quick thing. I think everybody can see them if they're up. But I think based on our prior conversations, I think we've seen some examples with all of the entities seeking special protection that there will be occasions where there is a use that is legitimate and not an infringement, such as news reporting or somebody who is entitled to use it for one reason or another. And so I think an exception process is in order. And this is something we worked on in the last group with Jeff in the IOCRC group. And I think that the goal here is to have a mechanism so that there can be a determination when an application is made as to whether it is legitimate or it is a cyber squatting or other type of illegitimate usage. And all we did was provide the four principles that we thought would be important here in setting up this mechanism. We could flesh out more details, but for the if the group wants to move forward, because we've worked on this before, and we haven't provided those details here. But, I mean, the most important thing is to have immediate notifications to an applicant and whichever the organization is that there are issues regarding that application, and establish a channel of communication between the organization and the applicant. And again, I would just say that this is not, as has been mentioned by one or more people over the course of this group's teleconferences, this is not to engender any kind of licensing at all, and that can be made very clear. This is simply to find out whether the use or intended use is legitimate or not, and then to provide some process, which would be impartial, which would be quick, which would not be expensive, to determine if there is the legitimate interest so that the string could proceed despite the fact that it is the same or similar to a protected string. And then, obviously, to take advantage of any existing procedures, which we have, and I know within the ICANN world we have many procedures for dealing with disputes, URS, UDRP, panels, et cetera. So to try to link into procedures that already exist and maybe add a procedure here for determination of legitimate use. So that's, in a nutshell, what we've done. And if we want to go further, we'd be happy to maybe fill in some of the blanks or try to at least provide options on some of these as to which routes could be followed in coming up with more details.
Thanks very much, Jim. That's certainly very helpful. And I see Chuck's hand up. Please, Chuck.
Thanks, Thomas. With regard to, I think it's the second bullet and my comments with regard to preferring that there doesn't need to be communication between the organization that's protected and the applicant, one of the things I noticed in the general counsel's responses in several instances with regard to the national laws was that they kind of referred to an exception procedure. If there was an exception, the organization needed to be involved to grant that exception. So that kind of jumped out at me when it wasn't in every case, but if you look through the general counsel's response, there are several cases in their description of the laws that did kind of call for communication between the applicant and the organization that's protected. So we may not be able to avoid that as I had hoped, but I just point that out and others can look at the general counsel's response to see what I'm talking about.
Can I comment on that, Thomas?
Yes, please do, Jim.
That's in there because I think in some of these matters, some of these applications, it will be very clear that an applicant is actually doing something that would be completely legitimate, and it would be easy to have that agreed to so that the process would not have to proceed into determination by a third party. So I think it's sort of to expedite, not to engage in negotiations or to engage in any kind of a licensing, just have a very short period of time to consent, period.
Jim, getting back to Chuck's question, do you possibly have experience with these statutory situations where organizations and questions are heard?
Or what?
Maybe there's somebody else. Chuck was saying that the General Counsel response mentioned that the organizations in question are heard during an exemption process, and the question is whether you or anybody else on the call has some practical experience with this as to how this works.
Well, I've had practical experience in various jurisdictions with people who have applied either for trademarks or for domain names who are legitimate, who do have legitimate uses and have sought consents, and they've gone very smoothly, frankly.
And was that process in a way where the organization in question is getting a short or longer period of time to respond, and if they respond in the affirmative, then I think there is no issue. But if the organization doesn't respond, would that lead to an auto-ack, auto-acknowledge, or to a NAC?
Well, luckily, I think, for us, almost all of the cases that we've been involved in have been cut off at the channel of communication because the users have been legitimate and the applicants have sought permission because they wanted to make sure that they didn't start doing something that would be objected to. So I think we've been sort of fortunate in that. We haven't, I mean, other than oppositions and other types of things in trademark matters, and obviously, cyber squatting complaints and UDFP actions and so on, we haven't, there's no process that we've had, a formal process in going beyond communications, except litigation type disputes.
Okay. Anybody else in the group want to chime in on this? Maybe share some practical experience, because I think that's very helpful in crafting proposals for exemption procedures. And if there are models that we can borrow from, that that's the easiest thing we can do. No? Okay. I mean, if you wanted to add to that later on or on the mailing list, you're certainly welcome to do that at any point in time. Maybe we can now go through the four stages and discuss them individually, if that's okay with you. I personally do have some questions, and maybe others have some questions too. Provide immediate notification to the applicant and the organization when an application is refused registration. I think I need some help from the registry and registrar colleagues that are here, but I guess in terms of language, what we're looking at is not a refusal, but it's technically a pending create, where the request for the creation of a second-level domain name, and I think we're talking about second-level domain names here, would be shelved, technically speaking, until some further information is there that allows for further processing. Is that notion correct? Can maybe somebody from registries and registrars chime in and confirm or say that this is incorrect? Because, Jim, I think we're not looking at refusal, but we're looking at, having the create request put that on hold. And I think the EPP
the scripture for that is pending create, and have that pending until the case is resolved, and if it's not resolved, then actually the registration is refused, but only at that point in time. I don't hear or see any comment on that. So, Barry, I would like you to keep note of that point, and I construe your silence as confirmation that you don't want to have the application refused instantly, but that you want to park it, technically speaking. And, Barry, let's reach out to the technical community and have confirmed what the status of that would be so that we can put it in here. Provide a channel of communication between the applicant and the organization. Chuck was asking what organization. I guess it's the organization that is holding the entry in the ICH, as we call it, the Identifier Clearinghouse, that you know might be an additional service of the Trademark Clearinghouse in terms of technical infrastructure, who knows. But the question is, who built up this channel of communication? Just to flesh this out a little bit, are we asking the, or are we proposing that the applicant gets, let's say, an email, or that it should revert to the Trademark Clearinghouse and get information or contact details to the ICH, where maybe contact persons for such process, or at least a role contact for such process, would be stored so that the applicant can go out and try to get some approval or documentation? Or is that a process that the group would like to see steered by ICANN?
Since it's
Jim,
an
please.
Existing procedure, I mean, the notices that are sent out on claims and that go to parties. I think, I mean, there could be just a add-on procedure in if this were a clearinghouse type operation where notices go to both parties so they're put in touch.
So the idea would be to notify both the wannabe registrant and the organization holding the entry in the ICH, and give them each other's contact details so that they can establish contact directly?
Yeah, I think so, and then try to resolve it at that level. That's, I mean, that's based on my experience, that's been a good way to resolve a lot of these things.
Yeah, good. Claudia, please.
Hi, I'd just like to also agree, as Jim just said, we have, at ISO, we have quite a bit of experience with would-be registrants or recent registrants of domain names coming to us and just seeking particular permissions on various different matters, and often it's just a matter of communicating different issues and finding a very quick and solution that doesn't really involve very much time or any money at all. So having some sort of a notification that would be sent, for example, copying both emails on file for both the applicant that they used to register the domain name and the organization as it's registered in the, you know, the I guess the Identifier Clearinghouse would be really, really helpful, and I imagine would take care of maybe one-fourth of the situations where it's just a matter of education or negotiation.
Thanks, Claudia. Chuck?
Thanks, Thomas. As I think we said in the drafting team for the IOC Red Cross work, there is some precedent for this in that the protection of two-character country code TLDs, or the two-character country code at the second level, a registrar or a registrant for that matter could go to those organizations and get their approval for using a two-character country code in some cases. So this would not be a first instance of doing something like this. I think that, you know, indicates that, you know, I think we can work out the details. Obviously, the protected organizations, whoever they are, would need to have a published point of contact with contact information for something like that to work, whether that was generally public or provided via some process when somebody wants to request an exception, that could be worked out.
So you're referring to the affiliates approach, right? That was first introduced by affiliates, which is now being alluded to in the applicant guidebook. You know, just to give some reference for working group members to look at.
Yes, and I think that in the new GTLD process, that was extended a little bit at the second level.
Thanks, Chuck. That's helpful. So the suggestion is that we look at that and look at the procedure for that. I guess the third bullet point might be a little bit more controversial because that says provide an impartial, expeditious, and expensive and inexpensive process for determining if the applicant has a legitimate interest and such that is that its application should proceed to registration despite its similarity to protected string. The question is, who does that? Because certainly in an ideal world, the organization concerned would just say or declare its consent with the registration, and then once you have that on paper or once you have whatever documentation might be required, you can get access to the name. But what if it's not as easy as that? So would denial of an organization per se lead to a block? I guess the fear has been voiced by some in the working group that organizations that have protection in the ICH or that have an entry in the ICH might not necessarily agree to use where the organizations are criticized. So they are afraid of views being suppressed if the organization itself it would be the only decisive factor to grant an exception or not. Chuck, please.
Thanks again, Thomas. Well, of course, the simplest way to do this, although it would be fairly restricted, would be to first verify that the organization requesting the exception was registered in the clearinghouse. And if it was, demonstrating some rights, then that would be a really easy way to answer this question. Now, I understand that that's fairly restrictive and doesn't cover the free speech issues that you were just addressing. But that would be very objective, very clear. If someone had a mark, like Olympic, for example, and had rights to that as evidenced by clearinghouse confirmation, validation, then that would qualify them to, you know, request an exception from the organization. Now, I guess I lean that way because it's really clean. You start getting into free speech rights and whether or not someone can register a name that's critical of one of the protected organizations and so forth gets a lot messier, which I like to avoid.
Thanks, Chuck. Yes, I think we all want to have it as easy and simple as possible, but chances for that to happen are quite slim, judging from experience. Claudia.
Hi, just following up on that and hoping to also make a suggestion that's a little bit clearer as well. I think Chuck's idea of having, for example, a basis of a registration, having as the basis of registration in the trademark clearinghouse, definitely as a one sign of a legitimate interest that would stop a block, I guess. Maybe another way of avoiding having to create a procedure, although that might be the best way, would also be that in cases of free speech or a sort of legitimate non-commercial use, the registrant would need to simply attest to that use, and if that use later becomes abusive, then that would be a basis, a further basis in bad faith, for example, under the URS or UDRP or a trademark infringement case on a national level. Perhaps having that as a faster way of trying to get at the idea of legitimate interest without requiring a process and perhaps a judge would be just to require that sort of a statement, signed or whatever, electronically, to make sure that at least there's this kind of fast opt out if you do have if you attest to using the domain name for a legitimate non-commercial purpose.
Thanks, Claudia. I think that's very helpful, and both your and Chuck's comment, I think one can have alternative criteria to look at. For example, in the document on the trademark clearinghouse, it says that during the sunrise phase, marks in the trademark clearinghouse, have to be honored. So one option could be to honor entries in the trademark clearinghouse for the ICH. And for the non-commercial use, where in most cases no right would be present that could be entered into the trademark clearinghouse, I guess what you're looking for, Claudia, is something along the lines of my earlier proposal, that one could abduct, so to speak, the idea of a public interest statement, maybe, or you were alluding to something which would be an analogy to the statement given by the registrant when he gets a trademark claims notice. Because if you then do not abide by that statement, then that itself can be used, if I'm not mistaken, as evidence of bad faith in a URS proceeding. Any further thoughts on that? From the group, because I think we need to take care of both legitimate commercial use in certain instances, as well as legitimate non-commercial use. And if you all agree, or if there's no objection to using those two alternative approaches that I've just described, then I would propose we just add them to the document, which leaves us with the question of who would prevail in case there is a contention between an organization that has the entry in the ICH and a third-party legitimate user? Do we say that per se, if the organization holding the entry in the ICH did not participate in the sunrise and get the name there, according to the registry's respective sunrise dispute resolution procedures for the resolution of contention sets, then the only option for them would be to oversee that no illegitimate third parties can get access to the names. But in the absence of that, it would be a level playing field, and they would not necessarily prevail over the organizations that are legitimate third party users. Claudia says that she likes the idea. Any further thoughts on that? Maybe from the organization seeking protection? Is that a risk that you would be willing to take?
Okay. Thomas?
Please, Jim, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we can look at that. We have some other details we could probably provide after this call. Because I think we're going in the right direction here. I think there needs to be some criteria established, and I think maybe we can build on your thought there.
Great, thank you. Any further comments or thoughts? Maybe I can ask David Maher in this case, specifically, David, because you are, if I'm not mistaken, also the free speech expert Is that approach something that you think could accommodate concerns of those that were concerned about free speech?
Well, I'm not sure. I hesitate to say anything on behalf of the NCUC. Robin Gross, of course, is the principal voice of that group. Generally speaking, my impression is that they object to any system that would require getting consent or permission. If there's going to be any objection procedure, that it ought to be after the event, that a registration takes place, and then the party who is making the objection proceeds to do so. I think you're going to have that issue coming up with any of these exemption procedures.
Thanks, David. I think what we do have here, at least that's my understanding, but please, the whole group, please correct me if I'm wrong, is we would have I think you call it a two-prong approach whereby you can get the organization's consent in the first place, and if that's granted, then you know, no further inspection is required. But in cases where such consent is not granted, one would look at the third bullet point of this impartial, expeditious, and inexpensive process, and that's what we being served describing as you know, using the trademark clearinghouse data or some other statement, whatever form that might have, maybe a public interest commitment sort of thing, or a trademark claims notice overruling, if you wish, by the registrant, you know, some sort of statement that the designation in question is being used for legitimate purposes. So that it would be my understanding that at least from what we've discussed today, legitimate users could get access to names even if the organization holding the entry in the ICH would object to it. You know, certainly on condition that legitimate use can be shown. But if that in itself would be reason enough to say no to the whole process, I think there is. I wouldn't be able to think of any exception process that didn't have at least very low hurdles. So I think that's the price of establishing these procedures. David, is that something that, you know, for you personally would be worth considering, or do you have huge concerns with what we've been discussing in the last couple of minutes?
Well, personally, I'm in sympathy here with the NCUC. I think that a consent process is not satisfactory. I would rather see an objection process, but that's my personal view, and I'm not sure that's the view of the registry stakeholder group.
Well, that's helpful, but that would mean ultimately, David, that we wouldn't be able to tweak the process so that you like it. So you would be against any preventative mechanisms, regardless of what they look like.
That's correct.
Thank you. Okay, any further comments on this? Otherwise, I would propose that maybe Jim, Kieran, and David, maybe you can inject your thoughts to Barry by email, and Barry, I'm sure, will be kind enough to amalgamate that with what we've been discussing today into an updated document. Is that something that you would be happy to do?
Sure.
Great. Thank you. Now, we have some time left, but I think that unless you have further suggestions or ideas that we should put into the document, we might be able to finish this call early today. Regarding the work plan, Stefan, please.
Thank you very much, Stefan Hankins with Crossway Crescent. Before we end the call, I was wondering whether we should not have a reflection on what we will bring to the table next week in the discussion with the legal counsel. I'm coming back to the initial point of the call, but I think that in my view, the group has set aside the legal counsel's opinion rather swiftly, and I would come back to the suggestion I believe that our chair made that, you know, we reflect on, you know, what additional information might have been required. As Jim noted at the beginning of the call, the legal counsel's office does recognize potential basis for challenges to be brought. I'm reading with respect to domain names, registration, including potential challenges to registry operators or registrars for their role in the registration chain.
Excuse me. Are you using hands-free? Can you maybe use the handset? The sound quality is...
I feel that, you know, the formulation of the question, and I believe we made this case in the calls and in writing, the formulation of the question put to the council was unlikely, I think, to provide a definitive answer to a question which focused on liability or risk of liability of registrar registries, if only because, if my understanding is correct, there is still unclarity on the actual liability of the registrar and registries under their role in the chain. I mean, are they off the hook? I'm not sure this is the right way to put it. Or are they agents of an abuse or violation of designations in their respective roles? I also feel that the question refers to any jurisdiction which prohibits any of the actions which are listed, and I'm not entirely sure that, you know, this is equal to the question of whether there is legal liability. I'm not entirely sure that this is fully identical, and I think, you know, this needs to be a little bit reflected upon. As we had also made the case very early on, I mean, the additional question that we would have thought useful to raise is the actual responsibility of ICANN itself to take all the measures within its authority to ensure that, you know, the protections are enforced. Articles of incorporation provide, you know, specifically refer to international law. So I think for next week's discussion with legal counsel, my view is that we owe it to the process and to the time that has gone into this to clarify indeed exactly what is lacking and what additional information would have been needed, bearing in mind, of course, you know, the complexities, you know, of that I mentioned. You know, is there jurisprudence which clarifies that the prohibitions under treaties and laws that were adopted before, you know, even anybody had even dreamt of, you know, what the internet has now become, you know, that, you know, we do need to to clarify, you know, what would be required additionally to what is there, and you know, the potentialities that the authors of the in the legal counsel of the paper have raised. What would be still needed and required? So I just want to put it like this, because I don't think that it's fair to the process. We've been waiting for so many weeks now for the opinion that we, you know, just put it aside and that will be it. That was the point I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stefan, and thank you for bringing this up. I think it's I very much applaud that you ask for more information on this, because I've encouraged the group to come up with further suggestions and questions earlier on, and therefore I think General Counsel will also appreciate the fact that we have follow-up questions, although I'd like to lower your expectations with respect to the liability of ICANN itself. I think that the message was more than clear that General Counsel was reluctant to respond on that, but I'm sure that Barry and Brian have taken good note of your suggestions, including the one on ICANN's liability, and ask General Counsel for clarification on that one. Just to avoid misunderstandings, Barry and Brian, I at least had some issues with the sound quality, which is why I have dared to interrupt Stefan in the meantime. Did you understand the full scope of the question to pass it on to General Counsel, or would you like Stefan to maybe summarize his concerns and send them to you by email?
Thanks, Thomas. This is Brian for Steph. Stefan, if you wouldn't mind, it would be helpful if you could summarize and put in writing an email. That way we can make sure that, indeed, we accurately convey your request. I also had a little bit of a problem with sound quality myself, so if you could, that would be very helpful and appreciated.
If I may, Stefan Hankins again.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
I think my point was not only, you know, not only our, you know, what we would like to put forward to legal counsel from our end. It was rather, you know, that we do clarify further and possibly, you know, in writing why this is neither conclusive nor even potentially, you know, in addition. Additional information for the reflection of the group. That was really much more my point than, you know, for us, you know, to provide yet another, you know, comment on how, you know, we feel, you know, the protections would require to be taken into consideration and duly implemented within ICANN's mechanisms. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan. Chuck is next.
Thanks again, Thomas. Assuming that I understood Stefan's questions there, I would also tend to want to lower expectations that we're going to get anything back from ICANN staff in that regard. And I'd like to point out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think our questions of General Counsel ask about liability. Okay, that was just the General Counsel's office way of responding to our question. They brought up the issue of liability, possible liability risk. We didn't ask what the liability was, and correct me if I'm wrong on that. So, I've heard a couple comments today that made it sound like we were asking about liability. We weren't. We were asking about registry and registrar responsibilities based on international law and multinational laws. And I think that they answered that. It may not be the answer that some of us wanted to see, but in their analysis, it's not clear enough in law to be a compliance issue or one that we could totally base a policy on. So I would also tend to want to lower expectations in terms of getting having ICANN General Counsel's Office fill in the blanks of what more they need. I'm not sure there is any more out there that they need. But again, I may have misunderstood the question. Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. And I'm sure that we will follow up on the mailing list on this one. So that leaves us with next steps. Barry, would you like to show the work plan to the group? So we see in there that our meeting today is at the very top of the table. Tomorrow is going to be a council meeting. There will be no report from myself to the council, so there's no event on that during tomorrow's call. We should further discuss our proposal maybe for the next two calls, and hopefully we're going to have the initial report summarizing the status of our discussions by then. Not sure whether that's still realistic. I'm looking at Brian and Barry now, who are in the process of drafting the report, and maybe you want to chime in and provide some information on that. But I'm not sure whether it's possible, but at least I would hope that at the beginning of April we have something to put out, because I think we've seen during today's call, between calls and during the last calls, that we're making progress in certain areas, but I think we need to put something in writing and put it out to the community to respond to make substantial progress, and then ultimately come up with an answer. There is the plan for a meeting in Beijing. I hope that some of you, preferably all of you, will be present in Beijing, and I'd very much like to have a face-to-face meeting with you in order to further to discuss things. But I think we shouldn't just have a meeting for the sake of having a meeting. I think those of you who've seen the very entertaining and instructive meeting tutorial by John Cleese, I hope you've seen it. Meetings, bloody meetings. One of the, I highly recommend it. They basically say you shouldn't have meetings for the sake of having meetings. And my question to you is, if we do this face-to-face meeting, whether you have any particular wishes as to what you would like to accomplish, so that we can go into that meeting as prepared as possible. You don't have to respond now, although I see Chuck's hand up, and it will be your turn in a moment, Chuck. Please do think about that. Talk to your groups. Consider issues that you find more suitable to be discussed face-to-face rather than being discussed on a list or during these calls. Chuck, please.
Thanks again, Thomas. I agree with you. We shouldn't have a meeting without having a clear agenda and a useful agenda. Unfortunately, you have to get a slot for a meeting so far in advance that I think we need to request a meeting slot, and if we had to cancel it, do that. It seems to me that it's quite likely we'll be able to come up with a very meaningful agenda based on where we're at and where we need to be. And the nice thing about the in-person meetings, it gives some new people a chance to come in and participate who may not have been able to in the past. So I would recommend that we reserve a slot for a meeting so that we get one. Otherwise, getting one after the cutoff date is almost impossible. So we can't wait until we know exactly what the agenda is, even though we will be asked to provide some sort of an agenda fairly well in advance. but that can be fairly generic. So that's just my recommendation from my experience.
Thomas and
thanks, Chuck.
Thomas, I'm sorry, this is Brian from staff. Chuck, in answer to your question,
Brian,
we did a slot. Actually, the cutoff date was February 20th. So we requested a slot on Monday, the late morning session, 11 to 12:30. They have not confirmed all the requests yet. The schedule is still pending. But we do have our request officially in.
Thanks, Brian. That's very helpful. And Barry has indicated to me that he will put out a doodle on the mailing list so that we can find out who from the group will be present in Beijing. I think that might turn out to be very helpful. But, Chuck, you're perfectly right. We should craft an agenda based on the findings that we then have. But I'd like the group to also think about, format, for example. You know, we might choose to have this a semi-open meeting, for example. Not only, certainly everybody's allowed access to it, but what we could do is try to encourage GAC representatives to join a meeting and then maybe in broader terms discuss where we came from, what we've achieved so far, where we are, where the difficulties are in the process, because I think that not only the GAC, but in the wider community, there are a lot of people who think we're completely crazy, wasting so much time in their view on something which they perceive as a small detail question. And, since this has been called a test case or a case study of PDP work in the GNSO, it might also be something that we could open up a little bit to raise understanding for what we're doing. And if there are people that are engaged, maybe GAC representatives or others, that are willing to comment and contribute to this process, I think it would benefit our exercise. You know, this is nothing for you to respond to now, although I see some activity in the chat. We can discuss this further on the list. Just think out of the box. Let's try to make the best use of our meeting when we see each other in person, which I personally look forward to very much. And with this, I think the only thing for me left to do is to announce the next call, which next week on Wednesday is going to be earlier by 2 hours than today. So we, in our rotation, we have the earlier call next week. And unless you have further comments to make, I'd like to thank ICANN staff for their excellent support. Again, as always, thank you for your participation and your constructive input, and I'm looking forward to continuing our conversation. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, John.